This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 114 was recorded on April 19th, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. We're going to deviate from our usual show format this week. As regular listeners will recall, when the volatility complex blew up at the beginning of February, we explained that significant corrections in equity markets generally take about 8 to 12 weeks to play out, and we emphasized that investors should both watch for a retest of those initial lows and then assess the market toward the end of that typical 8 to 12 week correction time window. Well, that time has now arrived, so we've invited three of our most popular guests to return for shorter than usual interviews, focusing on what's changed and what messages the market is sending our guests as we reach the end of that normal correction time frame. Harley Bassman, the convexity maven, kicks things off. Harley was kind enough to prepare an excellent slide deck for your reference during the interview. Registered users will find the download link in your research roundup email, or if you're not yet registered, just go to macrovoices.com and click the red button labeled Looking for the Download on our homepage. Next, Mark Cudmore, who heads up the Markets Live blog desk for Bloomberg in Singapore, returns for an update on his outlook since his first interview in January, just before the vol complex blew up. And finally, Mr. Eurodollar himself, Alhambra Partners CIO Jeff Snyder, will join us for a quick update on both his interpretation of the evolving situation in Hong Kong, where the Hong Kong Monetary Authority is having difficulty maintaining the Hong Kong's peg to the USD, as well as an overview of an excellent article that Jeff wrote recently describing the big U.S. dollar short.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the S&P 500 started off the week with a very quiet crawl higher. We were just edging right above the 2700 level on the S&P 500, a level that I've said in the past and something I've been sharing with my members is like, I want to see the bulls clear 2700 with conviction to really know that this market correction is over. And yet we sort of straggled up here to 2700, sat up there, and suddenly we now are 20, 30 points off the top. Are we in for another round of selling here, or is this just a short-term little throwback?
Well, Patrick, there's two key things I picked up on in the way that you asked the question. You described a shallow, gentle rally, and you talked about how you were looking for buying above 2700 with conviction. That's exactly, I think, the reason that I'm not persuaded by this. I don't see the conviction, and it's just been a shallow rally. But let's start with the bullish argument, because there is one, and we should cover it. We broke out of a consolidation range. Well, first we put in a double bottom, then there is a consolidation range, and we broke out of that consolidation range to the upside. And furthermore, that happened from a time standpoint just about the right amount of weeks after the original blow up for the correction to be ending. So if I look at how long it's been since the vol complex first blew up at the beginning of February, and I look at the shape of the chart pattern, it really looks to me like it's ending and we're headed higher. That's if you don't look at the volume. If you do look at the volume, you see that that conviction that you're talking about hasn't been there. So I still see the bearish argument as being stronger here, which is we don't see volume and we don't see momentum building as we get above 2700. If the smart money was convinced that the correction is over and we're headed up from here, they would be buying aggressively hand over fist and we would be rocketing to much higher levels on record volume. We're seeing anything but record volume. Meanwhile, Treasury yields back over 2.90 this week. That spells trouble ahead. So I don't think it's over yet. I think that we still have a push down, and I think that we're still going to see lower lows. Could be wrong, though. That bullish argument, you know, there's a few points there that really do make sense. From a timing standpoint, it should be over. We have seen that upside resolution to the trading range. I'm still not buying it, though. I think there's another push lower. We've got three great guests coming up, so we'll get their views as well.
Eric, let's move on to the U.S. dollar index, which remains very decisively stuck within that range between 89 and 90 and is not showing any signs of breaking out in either way of the range. What's your take on the dollar from here?
Well, I think you summed it up in your question, Patrick. We're stuck in that 89 to 90 range. And what that says to me is we're in an extended consolidation here. I don't think the market can decide which way to go. I've noticed that the chorus of bears who were calling for a dollar crash to happen imminently have kind of clammed up. But, you know, at the same time, I don't see action to the upside either. I'm definitely in the bearish camp in the long term. I think that the dollar is slowly losing its global hegemony over the financial system. It's losing its reserve currency status, but that is a slow motion event. For reasons that we've described in previous episodes of this program, Patrick, I see a really good argument for there to be a short squeeze and a move higher in the dollar. I want to ask Jeff Snyder about that when we get to his interview later in the program. But, you know, as far as what happens next, it's really anybody's guess. The chart's not telling us anything.
Eric, I wanted to just make one comment. You know, if you go back on the dollar index to 2013, going into the first part of 2014, for almost a year, we saw the dollar index stuck in a very tight 1-point range. It didn't last just 3 months like we're in right now. It lasted almost an entire year. I mean, we have seen in the past where after big currency moves, these currencies kind of just consolidate in ranges. And while I'm sure there will be a very big US dollar move of some sort of conviction, I mean, it also might not be a big shocker to see the dollar index stay like this well into the summer, and then a big move happens in the latter part of the year. Anyway, let's move on to crude oil. What's your take here on the price action? Well, clearly, we broke out. We almost printed 70 on the upside. What's your take here on oil?
Well, my prior view, as our regular listeners know, has been that there are several factors that I thought were setting the stage for lower oil prices. And specifically, that is the big run-up in price that we've seen has enabled the restart of so much activity in the shale patch. We've got rig counts rapidly increasing. We've got U.S. production increasing rapidly. And especially, there is just such an incredible imbalance of speculative long exposure in the commitment of traders reports. It seemed to me like that was really ripe for an unwind. And, you know, all the things that I predicted have come true. We have seen these increases in rig counts, and we've seen the increases in U.S. production. The thing is that just as I thought we were setting up to really see a washout that might start to unwind that big speculative long exposure, we've been overwhelmed, I think, with a combination of geopolitical concern ever since John Bolton was appointed National Security Advisor, and actually about a week earlier when I think the insiders got the word that that was coming. Prices have been going no place but straight up. Now what's come into view is we've got the OPEC meeting that is in June. Now, whether or not anything of significance happens at this OPEC meeting is almost irrelevant, because if there's one thing I've learned from my own past mistakes, Patrick, it is that when I try to analyze these things and evaluate whether or not any real news that's meaningful to supply and demand fundamentals is going to happen at the meeting, and I conclude that there's not, and I therefore think nothing's going to happen, well, guess what? These guys are expert. They are absolutely world class at using the period in the month or so leading up to these meetings to jawbone the market, and they're very, very good at it. So we're coming up, and you saw this week there was this nonsense headline that came out saying $80 to $100 oil would be welcomed by Saudi Arabia. Now, we know from their prior comments that they don't welcome $100 oil. They've said explicitly that they don't want that, but somehow this headline came out from sources, whoever sources are, that supposedly knew this information. Everybody with a brain should have immediately dismissed that and said, that's nonsense. We know better. That's not what they think. But that helped, I think, very much to propel oil much higher this week. So we're into that silly season in advance of the June meeting. And at the same time, we've got May 12th coming up, which is the deadline that's been given for the Iran nuclear deal. So between the risk of more geopolitical tension in Iran, the upcoming OPEC meeting, these are all things that come together to create bullish pressure in the market. Now, I still think the case is there for the bearish scenario to play out. And particularly, Patrick, if there was some sudden fundamental event that jerked the market lower, that started to cause a panic unwind of that record long speculative position, things could get ugly quickly. But you know, at this point, I think the balance of evidence has shifted more in the bullish case. So I'm not going to be surprised at all if we move into the 70s, above 75 to 80 on Brent, 70 to 75 on WTI. I don't think it can last long term, but I do think those kind of prices could last, let's say, from now until after the OPEC meeting in June. Depending on how things go on the geopolitical front, if Iran is over with one way or another and there's no lingering geopolitical upset coming out of that, and the OPEC meeting is over in June, I think that maybe sets us up for the bearish scenario that I described to play out. And certainly if prices move higher between now and then, the bearish sentiment's going to get even stronger and there's going to be an even bigger imbalance of speculative long positions. But as far as the washout that I was expecting down into the mid-50s, I don't see it happening now just because of all of this increased geopolitical tension as well as the lead up to the OPEC meeting.
Well, Eric, how did the inventories come in? Did that influence the price here in the last week?
They sure did. We saw a drawdown of 1.1 million barrels on national crude inventory, very much in line with analysts' expectations. Drawdown also of 1.1 million barrels in Cushing, Oklahoma. Again, these events on crude were not particularly spectacular unto themselves. They were pretty much consistent with expectation. But Patrick, it's the finished products where the real news came this week. Gasoline drawing down 3 million barrels, distillates drawing down 3.1 million barrels. Those were not expected. So that is the reason that a lot of people have said, okay, that's why we got such a huge move up on Wednesday. I want to come back to that because I don't think that interpretation is correct. But let's finish the inventory data first. Production up another 15,000 barrels to 10.54 million barrels per day. Remember, 20,000 barrels per week works out to 1 million barrels per year. Exports, 1.7 million barrels back up from last week. That works out to about 12.2 million barrels on the week that was exported and would otherwise have gone into a big build on inventory. The reaction, Patrick, to inventory was fascinating. There was a spike higher, and that's probably on the gasoline build, well above the top of the channel, the price channel that we'd seen on crude oil, but that retraced fully within 30 minutes. And then after that, it started to drift higher. Now, it feels to me this week like something more is going on, because after we had retraced that move up fully, it looked like the market wanted to sell off at that point. All of a sudden, we saw a face ripper of a rally higher. It reminds me of that Friday before the week where news came out that John Bolton had been appointed as National Security Advisor, where all of a sudden prices just went crazy to the upside on no apparent news. Now, what people were saying this week, Patrick, is, well, there was news. Look at that massive drawdown in gasoline inventories. Okay, well, fine. Look at that. Look at the RBOB gasoline chart. RBOB didn't take off nearly the way crude did. This was crude, not gasoline, leading this rally. Crude oil prices moved up something almost $3 in 24 hours. Why? I don't have a good explanation for that. 3 million barrel drawdown is not that big of a deal. It doesn't explain why we've seen this massive move up in prices. Now, it all reversed this morning. It looks like we've come down to the top of the channel. Are we just retesting it before advancing even higher? Certainly from a technical analysis standpoint, there's an argument to say that Thursday afternoon's close could be a bottom. We could be moving much higher. If that happens, it's confirming in my mind that there's more to the news than has been reported yet, because it feels to me like something's going on. That OPEC announcement that came out this week, you know, $80 to $100 per barrel is OPEC's target supposedly, has now been debunked. But look what it did while people were still talking about it, how much the price went up. We saw the White House on Wednesday, the day that oil prices were going through the roof, announce that they had told Vladimir Putin that there would be no further sanctions against Russia. And there was public news out that Russia was willing to make significant concessions and try to come to terms with the United States and everybody make nice and be happy so that there's no conflict between the U.S. and Russia. Why is crude oil going through the roof to the upside on a day when the news is suggesting the other direction? Feels to me like somebody knows something they're not telling here, Patrick.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because when you go in the broader commodity markets, we had industrial metals break out, the energy markets have been breaking out, but yet gold is just still hovering just underneath that kind of overhead resistance in the 1350, 1370 area, and we can't seem to break out like we are in the other commodity markets. What's going on here in gold?
Well, I think the dollar being stable in that trading range, you know, has eliminated any dollar-driven fundamentals for gold to move higher. People were previously anticipating that the dollar was about to break to the downside and gold was about to move higher. It's pretty clear that that's not happening. On the other hand, with John Bolton and the White House, I see plenty of reason to expect more geopolitical risk. Now, what I'm hearing and reading is that there has been something of a power struggle between Mattis and Bolton. It's not really clear who's got the president's ear. If that ends up working out to Mattis getting fired and Bolton's in charge, look out. I think that's time to buy gold and oil. On the other hand, if Bolton kind of gets sidelined and it becomes clear that Mattis is the one who is going to have the president's ear in terms of giving him advice on how to handle these geopolitical situations, it seems kind of odd that the guy named Mad Dog is the voice of reason in the room who's less inclined toward radical military action. But it seems like Mattis is more of the moderate, let's not start World War III guy, whereas Bolton is a little bit more aggressive in his style. So I'm watching very carefully for any signs of how that power struggle inside the White House might work out. Meanwhile, I'm kind of neutral on gold here, Patrick. I think it'll be geopolitical tension, either escalation or de-escalation of geopolitical tension, that brings the next move in gold. I just don't know which way it's going to be yet.
Now, Eric, I just wanted to throw in one comment on silver, because we always talk about gold, and rarely do we give an update on gold's little cousin, silver, which obviously usually has a strong correlation. But what's interesting was that in silver, the buzz, at least for the last month, has been how the commitment of trader reports have reached basically some pretty extreme levels. I mean, to put it into context, we on the commitment of traders, the commercial hedgers, a year ago were short over 120,000 contracts, and now they're almost flat. And we've seen in the month of March, the first time that the large speculators went from being net long to actually being net short. And so we saw this almost flip-flop in the commitment of trader reports. And suddenly, when silver has this big breakout, goes from 1650 all the way to 1724 with a very decisive day yesterday breaking up there. It's really interesting to see whether silver has a short squeeze dynamic and how that actually plays out with gold. Now, finally, Eric, I wanted to just ask you about these 10-year yields, because just the other day, it looked like it was just going to be another one of those weeks where we were going to say, oh, they're stuck in a range. But just the last 24, 48 hours, we saw a pretty big jump in yields. I think we're approaching north of 290 right now. What are you thinking here on yields?
Yeah, my screen says 291 right now on Thursday afternoon, and clearly the short squeeze that we thought might be materializing in the Treasury market didn't happen, or hasn't happened yet, up 10 basis points from last week. We're not quite at crisis point yet, but if we start to move above 3%, and particularly if we move above 3.05, which Julian Brigden told us was the critical red line in the sand to watch, that could really lead to some dramatic knock-on effects in other markets, particularly equities, to the downside. So it's going to be very interesting to see what's happening. I don't really have a strong view on what's driving this week, but I'm watching it carefully. And I think especially if we get in the high 90s or approaching 3%, it's really time to buckle your seatbelt for what could be coming in the equity market.
All right. Well, thanks for the summary, Eric. Now, our first interview guest is Convexity Maven's Harley Bassman. Eric's interview with Harley is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Harley Bassman, perhaps better known as the Convexity Maven. I should point out to our listeners that we are taping this segment on Tuesday afternoon, so our discussion will not reflect anything that happened in Wednesday and Thursday's markets. Harley, I think the big question that's on everybody's mind is, you know we've got at least a correction that's in play. We have now retested those lows that we saw about 8 weeks ago. If it was a correction, it's probably time for the correction to be over, at least historically. You know, it's about 9 weeks. It's about time. On the other hand, it could be that we're beginning a bear market. So the big question on everybody's mind is, how will we know when the real bear market is on? And conveniently, you've recently written a piece titled, How Will We Know? Tell us the overview. How do you know whether it's a correction or a bear market, and what do you see on the horizon?
Well, thank you for inviting me to the show. Pleasure to be here. You know, I have a couple of big thoughts, you know, and if you go to my website, convexitymaven.com, you can see some of my past commentaries. You know, the Fed, the ECB, BOJ, China, they've pumped money into the system and kind of elevated everything. And using financial repression, they've taken rates down and forced money into riskier assets. And along with that, you've seen this increased correlation between interest rates and equities. So for the last 59 years, they move in opposite directions, stocks up, bonds down, and vice versa. This is very different than what it was prior to 2008-09, where kind of they moved more or less randomly. What you've seen over this time is people kind of building up positions in risk parity, low volatility, passive investing, that kind of takes advantage of the self-hedging nature of stocks and bonds. I think what's going to happen at some point is you're going to see stocks and bonds both decline. Interest rates go up and stocks decline. And when that happens, this leverage in the system is going to have to unwind. So that's what I'm watching for. And you can look for it on Bloomberg or other sources that basically show the correlation of interest rates to equities.
So the message is basically that it is going to be the signal that tells us when it's the game is on, so to speak, will be the increase in interest rates and treasury yields. Is there a magic number? You know, we had Julian Brigden on the show recently. He said 3.05 is the magic number on the 10-year. Other people have said 3%. Some people have said even higher. I think you sent us a chart from Credit Suisse that says 3.5% is the magic number on the 10-year yield. What, from your perspective, is the number on the 10-year that tells you, oh boy, we're in for trouble now?
I think 3.25 to 3.5, somewhere in there, both on a technical level and a fundamental level, because it would require inflation to be over 2% to get the cash tenure above 3.25, 3.5. But to circle back to your question, I think the issue is this, that convexity, which is, you know, in geeky terms, a second derivative, but it really means is the payoff profile of an investment. So if something is positively convex, you make two or lose one for the same risk up and down. Negatively convex instruments, you lose three, make one. So you lose more than you make. Now, in exchange for taking trades like that, investments like that, you usually get a higher yield. And that's what you've seen happening is the Fed, via this QE process and financial repression, has pushed people to reach for yield. And they've been reaching for yield by selling optionality, selling convexity, selling this unfavorable profile. What I think is, since people are inherently not risk neutral, losing a dollar hurts more than the pleasure of making a dollar. That's just human nature. And therefore, since you have this negative risk preference, I think people are going to be really kind of shocked if they start losing money at not a crash, but just kind of some kind of they stop making it easily. And I think once they start to unwind these positions because of their fearfulness, that could go and create problems. When an instrument is negatively convex, to rebalance it, you have to go and move in the direction. So if you're short options and prices go down, you have to sell that asset to rebalance yourself. And by selling, you push the market down lower, which then, because of the convexity, it's not linear, it forces more selling. And that's how you get this feedback loop. Risk parity might be the biggest culprit here. You have people who are long stocks. So in my article, I go through the idea of where maybe you're long $100 of stocks and $300 of bonds. And the idea, because bonds might move, let's say, you know, a third as much as stocks in the opposite direction, it's self-hedging. But if both go down, then you got to go and reduce that leverage. You could no longer have $300 or $400 of assets being supported by only $100 of cash, of equity value. And so I think people are not prepared for this. We've had basically 9 years of, you know, except for a few moves, relatively low volatility. So buying the backup has been the trade that's worked. And I think when we get to a point where that doesn't happen, that's when you get it. Adding on to my first piece, I said that I thought a 4% move could be enough in a single day to trigger this kind of hedging action, this fear of consequence. And if you look at my latest commentary, I have these charts side by side. And basically, once the S&P was down by about 4%, the VIX just exploded higher. It wasn't an exact trigger. I will say better lucky than smart. It could have been 3.5%. It could have been 3. It could have been 5. But that was the general idea. And we got that. And in the same way, I kind of think that once you see stocks and bonds no longer self-hedging themselves, you will see this unwind of leverage, which means people have to sell. Selling pushes prices down.
You know, this is what concerns me the most about your forecast, and also a lot of other people have said the same thing. A lot of conventional wisdom says, okay, look, you know, it's retail investors are the ones who panic. Professionals don't panic. They don't do that. You know, they're fully hedged. Well, wait a minute. If you look at the 20-year buildup in these risk parity strategies where everybody assumed that the bond exposure was going to hedge the equity exposure, if what we find is that that correlation is reversed, as you say, and both bonds and stocks sell off at the same time, it seems to me that that's a perfect setup for an institutional panic. And, you know, maybe it's a slower motion panic than a retail panic. But do you think I'm exaggerating to use the word panic in conjunction with what could happen in institutional finance if we see both bonds and stocks selling off dramatically at the same time?
Respectfully, I think the word panic is a misnomer over here. I'm not sure you have to go throw in the it's kind of, you know, a little, you know, panic, fear, emotion, you know, catches headlines. Why can't it just be the natural reaction function of quantitative funds, quantitative managers, readjusting their portfolios to reflect the new correlations? If you see the new correlation that stocks and bonds are no longer working in opposite directions, then these managers who are quant managers, and they might use a 3-month or 6-month moving average, they will readjust their portfolios. They're not going to panic. They'll just do what they're supposed to do, what they've been doing for the last 9 years. But instead of buying more assets, that's what they've been doing, because the hedge value of bonds to equities works so well, they'll reduce assets. And so if you have $400 million of assets, and you're going to go with $300 million of assets, you're going to sell $100 of stuff. I don't call that panic. I just call that the reaction. And I don't think it's going to be retail that drives this. Retail has been moving into passive funds. So they don't have to go and make these decisions. It's the quant managers who will make it for them. So I don't foresee a crash. I foresee some degree of a slow grind. It's your classic, frog in the boiling water. You know, you put the frog in the pot and it's cold water. You turn the temperature up, and the time you realize he's cooked. You never actually feel the hot water.
Well, you make an excellent point. I shouldn't use a word like panic, because you're right, that implies emotion. But I guess what strikes me is if, as you say, we have simply a reaction function of people doing their jobs and adjusting their correlations, if suddenly what's happening is, as you say, everybody is selling assets across the board, both equities and fixed income, and they continue to do that, as you say, perhaps it's a slow grind, but it sounds to me like it's a setup for a long sustained period of asset devaluation in both equities and fixed income. And I guess what that makes me wonder then is, as much as the Fed claims that they're not in the business of rescuing financial markets, how long do you think that can go on before they change their story and try to do another QE round or something else to rescue the market?
I think, well, it certainly depends upon how fast it is. If you get to the same place, but you do it slowly versus quickly, you know, it doesn't grab the headlines, it just slowly happens. I mean, if you want a date for when I think things are really going to start to become in peril, it's going to be first quarter next year. In theory, with the best minds on Wall Street, that should be when the Fed, the ECB, the Bank of Japan, net, 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 all three combined, are draining reserves out of the system. The move up has been all three going north. Once they're all selling, or at least not buying, that should be it. Because remember, money's fungible. So if Japan's buying and U.S. is selling, if net-net money's coming in, people in Japan or in Europe, they could buy dollars. First quarter next year is when this happens. And if you start to have, of course, in conjunction with this the new budget, which is more supply of debt, that could make bonds go down and stocks go down, and there you'll have it. And then I think the natural course is these quant managers will have to go and readjust. And of course, the risk is that because of the underlying negative convex profile of the market, it'll be more difficult to unwind without actually pushing prices around.
Shortly after the last time we had you on the program, we had Chris Cole on just after the vol complex blew up. And his reaction was, he said, look, folks, don't think it's over yet. What you saw was just the appetizer. That was the explicit short vol trade that blew up. But the main event is the implicit short vol trade, which comes in the form of risk parity, vol control, and share buybacks. And he said he had no idea when it would happen, but he thought that the implicit short vol blow up was really the main event that was going to be it. Is what you just described starting in the first quarter of next year what he's talking about, or is it something different?
Look, I love Chris Cole. He's one of the best guys out there for convexity and options, and one of the best writers also. The idea of the VIX blowing up was always, I would say, easy, but kind of reasonable. If you look at how those profiles of the XIV and other kind of vol roll-down strategies, they relied upon basically at some point picking up pennies for the steamroller. Being short the VIX at 10, 11, 12 just can't be a career-enhancing trade. And the people who were in those trades were mostly professionals or at least faster money people. And because of the leverage, once it started to go south, they had to get out quickly. And the hedging action exacerbated. To hedge out the short VIX, you had to go sell the market. As you sold the market, the VIX went higher. There you go. I think Chris is right about the implicit vol convexity of this parity. I disagree about it being a speedy collapse. I think it'll be more insidious, and you'll all of a sudden wake up and see yourself down, 10, 15% over time. I don't think it's going to be a panic, because I think these risk parity funds, they buy and sell programmatically. The idea of these computer programs is to take the human emotion out of the process. So they will readjust accordingly. It may require them to sell every day, but they're not going to look at the market and hit the bid. They're going to look at the recent correlations and adjust accordingly.
Now, you gave us a prediction for when this would start, first quarter of next year. Do you have any predictions for how long it would last? Is this a six-month thing, or is it a six-year thing for it to play out?
I have some charts we used last time I was on the show. And one of my favorites, I'm a huge believer in demographics. Demographics is the iceberg. All we see is the top 10%, but the underlying baby boom generation pushing through the life cycle is the main driver. And if you look at the workforce growth rate versus the 10-year rate, over the last, at least 70 years, it's, I won't say lockstep, but pretty close. Where I get my 3.25, 3.5 is where 10-year rates start to actually break trend with the growth rate of labor. And I think what's going to soften the blow of bonds going down in price, up in yield, is just the mere fact that boomers need to sell stocks and buy bonds. And if you go look at, and I had this in one of my write-ups recently, the 10-year move of mutual fund flows, there's been no money. Net, 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 no money in equities. It's all going to bonds. The buyers of equities has all been corporate stock buybacks. That's the net buyer. And I think that continues. I think you still need baby boomers who are retiring, which is like 10,000 people a day, plus insurance companies and liability managers who need to go and basically buy bonds to fund retirement pension plans. I think that'll soften it. So you're not going to get like a 1980-84 bond blow off. So it'll happen, but it'll be slower.
Now, as we look to navigate this whole process that you see on the horizon, one of the things that a lot of smart people are starting to sound warning bells about is a return of secular inflation. We've heard some pretty smart people like Hugh Hendry and Julian Brigden say, look, this is 1965. A major wave of inflation is coming. On the other hand, people like Russell Napier, who's also very well respected, he just wrote a piece saying, this is crazy talk. If you look at what's going on right now, the U.S. Fed is extinguishing U.S. dollar supply while other central banks are creating additional supply of their currencies. It's crazy to expect inflation in the U.S. dollar in this environment. Which side of the fence are you on, and what do you see? Is there a risk of a return of secular inflation as this bond sell-off is occurring starting next year?
No, notwithstanding that I'm a UChicago, MBA who believes in, idea of printing, what have we done, $10, $12, $15 trillion of cash via the Western central banks. Like, you can't print money and not get inflation, but it's a matter of when. And I think what you're going to see, the inflation of the 70s and 80s, if you look back, it was strictly a function of labor force growth rate, the baby boomers, becoming age 35 to 50. That's where you have maximum spending, household formation. That's when the inflation occurred. Since we pushed through that demographic, you see inflation you should see inflation pick up again 2023, 24, 25. That is when you're going to see the millennials start to really flow into the workforce, and the boomers by then will have kind of petered out. And the demographic, I mean, it's baked in the cake, man. You can't go backwards and birth anybody. It's not Benjamin Button style. So we already know what the workforce demographic is. The only interesting chink on this thing would be immigration policy. If that changed dramatically, then you could stymie labor force growth rate.
Talk to us about the U.S. dollar. Some people have said, look, it's bottoming here. Other people have said, sell this bounce because it's about to crash. What do you see on the horizon for the dollar as this whole story plays out over the next few years?
I don't see the dollar making a huge move one way or the other. It's still the reserve currency of the world. It's still where you got to go. I mean, if people are willing to go and buy Swiss francs, for God's sakes, as a reserve currency for safety, the U.S. dollar certainly is an awful lot better than that by, you know, scale, size, everything else. So, and as you know, the world becomes a little more scary with what's happening in various places, people are still going to want to have U.S. dollars. It's a safe place to be. I guess people could argue that maybe Bitcoin is where you go, but as I've written about, I think that's ridiculous. Bitcoin is, it's not going to zero, but it's a place where for gamblers. It's not an ultra currency.
Well, Harley, I have to agree with you on Bitcoin, although that's a sensitive subject for some people. Before we close, I want to ask you one final question. As you look at what you see on the horizon, what general advice do you have to investors in terms of how to navigate this market?
For investors in general, my comment would be people get focused very much on entry level. They want to buy the top or sell the top, buy the bottom, whatever it might be. They'd always try to time the market, try to day trade. I just don't believe in that. I think it's very difficult even for pros to do that. I think sizing is much more important, especially in a market that's going to be negatively convex, which means you get very quick moves up and down, which could be nerve-rattling. If you want to be a long-term horizon investor, you should size your positions such that you can take a drawdown and not get forced out. And if you do that, you'll be successful. If you try to time the market, at some point you're going to get hurt. I mean, if you look at the VIX right now, it's back to 15. So I guess if you, in theory, you'd stayed short, you know, you would have been okay. But you couldn't stay short. You got stopped out. People were in levered positions where they were forced to curtail that the loss. It was too big. And that was always what you saw from all the commentators, was not per se, I mean, people might say that 12, 13 is too low on the VIX, but that was never the key selling point of why this was going to be a catastrophe. It was the size of the position and the ability to unwind it was just not there. So that'd be my advice to people, is sizing is more important than entry level.
Well, Harley, you are unlike our other guests because you're not selling anything, so we don't have anything to promote, but you are kind enough, despite the fact that you're kind of retired from your professional days of finance, you still write quite a bit and share it with people who are interested through your website, convexitymaven.com. You also have a mailing list associated with that. Please tell people how they can sign up if they'd like to receive your free mailings.
It's on the bottom of my site. You can send me an email, harley@baspin.net. And I'm also on Bloomberg. You can ping me there.
Well, Harley, I can't thank you enough for another fantastic interview. We really appreciate it. I'll be back with Patrick Ceresna and then Mark Cudmore as Macro Voices continues here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Harley. Great to have him back. The one thing that I had to take away from that interview is that real view that we have amongst our guests. And there's two camps. There's those that view quantitative easing as money. And this money was injected into the system and it has to create inflation. Eventually, it's going to flow through. And then there's the other camp who view that quantitative easing was simply creating bank reserves. And while it just becomes bank reserves on their balance sheets, it has to, through the credit creation engine, disseminate back into the system in order to create that inflation. And some argue that only went into share buybacks and other things, but it never disseminated into the populace where the money would actually create the inflation. And these two schools of thought are very common. And I sort of have opinion I'm in the latter camp there. But I don't know. What's your take on that?
Well, Patrick, if I think this through logically, it's very clear that what happened, despite people, including myself, predicting that QE would be very inflationary, it did create bank reserves. It really did not transmit a lot of money and credit into the real economy. So as far as too much money chasing not enough products and services, it didn't create that kind of inflation. On the other hand, it certainly did create asset price inflation, and wildly so. So my take is what's going on now is as the Fed is reducing its balance sheet, you've got an unwind of that. And it's true that to say, there has to be inflation coming or not coming or whatever. Well, if it wasn't really creating inflation into the real economy, you don't have to worry about that aspect of it. What you do have to worry a lot about is if asset prices were pumped up by all of this money that went into the system and the Fed is now contracting their balance sheet, what does that mean for asset markets? Not for wage and price inflation in the real economy, but does it create a massively deflationary force in asset markets? And I think that there's a good, strong case that it will. Now, if you think that there's deflation there and there's no case favoring inflation in the general economy as a result of QE, which is what I've just said, sounds good. But how come guys like Julian Brigden have got all these great charts that show real signs in hard data that inflation is making a resurgence? And by inflation in this context, I don't mean asset inflation. I mean inflation in the real economy. So it seems like the data is telling us inflation may be coming back in the real economy. But as Russell Napier argued, look at what the Fed's actually doing. They're extinguishing U.S. dollar supply. So I think that there could be a very deflationary effect in asset markets. That's where the inflation occurred. It's very easy to say there's no reason to think quantitative easing per se should have led to any kind of inflation in the real economy. But, you know, look at Julian Brigden's chart book. There's a lot of stuff in there that says inflation is making a comeback.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see whether or not this is just like a cyclical push in inflation that is going to fizzle out, or whether this is actually sustained almost like a secular kind of push in there. But that's something I guess we'll find out as we move forward. So, Eric, what did you take away from the interview?
Well, the biggest thing that I took away, and it's kind of where I started, is, okay, what is the big signal that is going to tell us it's game on and secular bear market is happening in the stock market? And the answer is when Treasury yields get too high. And I'm convinced that that's the right answer. Okay, what's the too high number? Is it Julian Brigden's 3.05, which is rapidly approaching on the 10-year? Or is it more like 3.25 to 3.50 on the 10-year, which is still a long ways away, that Harley was talking about? I think Harley is such a gentleman and a professional. He's not going to make something up to sound confident and authoritative. He'll tell you like it is. I don't know the exact level, and that's exactly what he told us. I don't think anyone probably has any magic crystal ball that tells them, but I think it is Treasury yields reaching some critical threshold level where everything falls apart. And Patrick, I don't know what that threshold level is. I don't think anybody does. I guess we'll find out when we get to it. In any case, let's go ahead and move on now to our next feature interview guest, which is going to be Mark Cudmore. Our regular listeners will remember that Mark joined us just before the vol complex blew up at the end of January. So let's get an update from Mark on how he sees the market in the wake of this correction that's now played out over the last 10 or 12 weeks.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next as our second feature guest is Mark Cudmore, who heads up the Bloomberg Markets Live blog in Asia. Mark, last time we had you on the program was just before everything blew up. Very much to your credit, you had written a piece almost immediately after we last had you on the program saying, hey, the one thing that could really derail this equity market rally would be the breakout of a trade war. Needless to say, that's one of the things that's happened here. But I want to start with just a really high-level big picture. What would you say is going on? Is this about the trade war? Is this about the vol complex blowing up? Is it about bond rates? What is it that brought this on? And do you think this is just a correction right now? Or do you think we're looking at the beginning of something much bigger?
So I think we are just in the middle of a correction. And I think overall, the structural story is still pretty positive. But this is a correction that may not be over yet. And you're asking kind of what kind of drove this. And I think one of the things that happened here is that this is a market that was probably overdue a correction after such an extraordinary 2017 rally with no volatility. And suddenly we had a load of factors at once that were kind of very relevant. And there were some dynamics that genuinely changed. As you mentioned, trade war is my big worry for markets. That's the kind of thing that I said, this could actually turn this into a proper bear market, a recession. I'm still hopeful that we're going to avoid a full trade war, but obviously it's concerning how much kind of tensions have been ratcheted up already so far. And that remains my big worry, that this will kind of end the cycle early. On top of that, though, what really changed in January is we had the market get extraordinarily bullish. I mean, we already had seen great gains through all of 2017, and then suddenly in 2018, in January, the market kind of went a little bit crazy to the top side. So we suddenly had everyone get super bullish at a time when we were seeing an extraordinary tightening in U.S. yields. The front-end tightening was the greatest we'd seen since the first half of 2008, and obviously we know how that year ended in the U.S. And it was a real yield tightening as well, because inflation really isn't accelerating as much as some people would have you believe. Yes, it is ticking up, but the yield tightening was extraordinary. So we had a real kind of sudden hit to liquidity at a time when people had really got stretched to the top side. That left the market particularly vulnerable for something kind of negative to happen. And of course, then we got the negative catalyst. And there are now several different strands to this now. You know, the trade is certainly one part, but as you kind of mentioned, there's the tech story as well, where there's been quite a few kind of negative dynamics in the tech sector. And there's a worry here that the tech sector might experience greater regulation, kind of an oversight in the years coming forward. That means greater legal costs, greater compliance costs, might even mean greater taxation. And since tech has been such an important part of why kind of the global bull market in equity, if tech is going to have a serious blow to earnings, well, that might undermine some other valuations. But all that said, despite the fact there's a lot of reasons to be kind of still concerned in the short term and still expect a lot more volatility in the months ahead, I think that the structural story remains very good. So we may not have bottomed out quite yet for the medium term, but we probably will go on to make new record highs in the next year. And that's because we still have those kind of three background pillars that I always refer to. The global growth is good. It's maybe not accelerating anymore. It may have peaked out, but global growth is still overall strong. Asia is still very strong. And the G10 world, no one's particularly exciting, but no one's doing terribly. Earnings have obviously been great. Again, there's probably not much going to be much upside from that going forward, but certainly earnings have been a very strong part of the story. And finally, liquidity has taken a short-term blow in terms of the U.S. yields tightening. But overall, central banks are still pumping money into the system. Not the Fed, but the Fed haven't been pumping money into the system for 4 years now. But the PBOC, the ECB, they're both heading towards $6 trillion balance sheets. It's quite incredible, really. And as I said to last time I was on, the Fed is actually the fourth biggest central bank in the world in terms of balance sheet already, and the others are accelerating away from it. So there's still liquidity coming into the system. So those three pillars overall are positive, and that's why I don't think we're at the end of the economic cycle, and that's why I think equities overall will make new record highs probably later this year, maybe next year, but that doesn't mean that the correction is over just yet in terms of the short term.
Now, some people have talked about a very vulnerable point below the market still, down around 25, 35 on the S&P. I know that several people have written about that, some of them covered on Bloomberg. Do you think that there is a risk of an acceleration there if there's a stop loss effectively in the market at that level?
Look, I would have been someone who would have thought that we might have had several acceleration points already. And so I'm loath to get too excited about one particular technical level on the downside. But that said, I do think there's probably reason to think we do have a little bit more downside in the weeks and months ahead. I think one of the things that the market has struggled with in the last couple of months is that because we had so little volatility last year, they're now struggling to adapt to themes that take months to play out. And they kind of want them to play out in the space of a day or two. And trade negotiations is a perfect perfect example, where this is an ongoing dynamic that's going to kind of ebb and flow. There's going to be positive elements, negative elements. It might overall turn out okay. I do buy into the argument that neither side wants a full, you know, scale trade war, and therefore there will be some kind of compromise. But we can expect to be, you know, in positive points where it looks like we're about to reach the end, and then we'll suddenly get a negative kind of turn again. So I think that story will play out for a long while. And the tech story is another one that will continue to play out for a long while as well. So I think that people are trying to play these themes too quickly. Another thing that plays into that is because we didn't have much volatility last year, a 2% move this year is suddenly causing panic. But this is kind of going to become the new normal in terms of at least 1% moves will become the new normal. And therefore, we need to not read so much into several percent move over a few days in one direction. So that said, I do think we'll probably see lower levels again in the S&P and global equities. I'm not super high conviction on that, but if that would be my base case, that we will probably see lower levels in the kind of month or two ahead. But ultimately, there'll be at some point when you kind of can turn around for kind of the long-term climb higher again.
Since we're talking about trade concerns, why don't we come back to the U.S. dollar itself? Now, last time we spoke, a lot of people were making very bold, high conviction calls. Some of them dollar bulls saying, okay, the bottom's in, we're about to bounce just dramatically higher. Others saying dollar's about to crash, world is coming to an end. Interestingly, ever since we last spoke, we've seen really nothing but a sideways consolidation pattern. The market's just trading sideways. What do you make of the U.S. dollar, and where do you see it going from here?
Yeah, my view here on the dollar hasn't changed that much, and that was the view that overall I'm a secular dollar bear and think there's a long-term multi-year downtrend. But I did think in January that we are kind of ripe for a proper bounce that might last for a few months. That bounce never came, and as you said, in fact, we're slightly weaker, but really we've gone nowhere. Unfortunately, it's probably a bit boring, but I'm kind of in the same view that overall I do believe in the long-term dollar downtrend. The dollar's dominance in global trade, in global exchange, is slowly eroding. We're seeing that in the SWIFT payments, where dollar peaked out at 45% of global SWIFT payments, and now it's down to 38%, and it's a steady declining trend. So overall, we're just seeing the dollar is becoming slightly less relevant as the U.S. economy slowly loses its kind of dominant share in the world economy. It's less than 25% of the world economy now, but that's a declining number as kind of China and India in particular are seeing such extraordinary growth. And with dollar kind of amounting to almost 63% of global reserves, I think that kind of mismatch will slowly kind of close over time. So I believe in the long-term multi-year dollar kind of weakness. That said, I'm still waiting for this kind of short-term bounce, and I think 2018 can bring a very powerful bounce. And part of the reason for that is that U.S. growth is one of the strongest in G10 this year. It wasn't last year when people were bullish dollar and that went wrong. And also on the yield side, as I said, the real yields in the U.S. are extraordinarily positive and very attractive. And so I think that those, the real yields and growth argument will be two of the key drivers that kind of might see the dollar see a kind of powerful bounce of a few percent at some point in 2018. But ultimately, it won't be a turn in trend. It's just going to be a bounce in the long-term downtrend.
Let's come to interest rates and treasury yields next. The last time that you were on the program, we had a few people starting to come out saying, okay, you know, bond bear market is on, but they weren't that numerous. Now, since then, we've moved about 30 basis points higher on the 10-year yield, and all of a sudden, there's just a chorus of voices saying, okay, that's it. It's over. The jig is up. It's all headed downhill from here. Last we spoke, I think you were really not very much of a long-term bond bear. Has that changed at all? Have you been persuaded by the growing number of bears?
Not at all. I think it's roughly the same story. At the time we spoke last, I said, you know, I expect the long end to stay in a kind of volatile range, and overall that we'd see kind of further curve flattening as we go through the cycle. We have seen a little bit of more curve flattening since then, but we still have a lot more to go. I do expect that the curve will ultimately invert before the end of the cycle, and that's why I'm also not worried that the end of the cycle is that close. It's probably going to be 2020 or so, based on kind of historical precedent in terms of the curve signal. So I do think we've still got about 45 basis points of flattening to go between the 2 years, 10 years, and I expect that to happen over the months ahead. But again, this is not something that happens in the next few weeks. It's something that happens, you know, over a many years process. I do think that in the 10 years, you know, when we last spoke, I said we could see spikes up to 3%, and we've seen those kind of spikes. Maybe perhaps the range is even higher than I thought. I think at the time we were speaking, I didn't state this, but I was kind of thinking that 3% is probably toward the top end end of the range. Maybe perhaps the top end of the range in 10 years, probably more, maybe 3.2% or something like that. But I think the overall dynamic is still there, that I expect 10-year yields to kind of bounce around the range, but not really go anywhere. I think the structural disinflationary pressures are just too large, and that's coming from technology, from demographics, and also from the fact that we just still have this liquidity in the system, which is, I think, just going to keep on kind of chasing yields whenever they go too high. And we saw that in the U.S. earlier this year.
Let's move on to commodities. A lot of people who are the same people that are saying inflation is on the rise are projecting a really big move up in commodities. Oil has certainly moved higher. I think a lot of that is geopolitical. Base metals have moved up a bit, but across the board, I don't see massive changes. What do you think in terms of the commodity outlook?
Well, when we last spoke in January, I said to you that one of the things that I really got wrong at the end of last year was that the move in oil was sustainable, the climb higher. And I'd been someone who kind of thought that oil would never sustainably climb much higher again. So having got that wrong, I've kind of avoided having too strong a view in oil in 2018 so far. But looking at it, you know, it does look like oil is quite comfortable up here. Obviously, there is very large speculative long positioning, but the fact is they're getting paid for that kind of that position. The backwardation the curve is massive, so there's a carry from holding that view. And I think it does look like that oil can kind of stay up here for a while. At some point, I do think that supply will pick up, and we're seeing the U.S. rig count pick up, and that might see oil come off a certain extent. But overall, commodity outlook looks slightly brighter than I probably thought a couple of months ago, and that's why perhaps the yield range is maybe slightly higher than I was thinking, because that might justify why we get a spike up that goes a little bit farther than I was thinking. But overall, my commodity view isn't changed too much. I'm still constructive on metals, and that's because I think the global growth story is still good. And as I said back in January, because of I'm not close enough to the metals market, I kind of refrain from any short-term tactical view, but I'm overall constructive. I think oil, I'm kind of staying away from having a view, having gotten it wrong, but it does look like it's comfortable enough up here. And I think, look, food prices, I think, was one of these big stories and another thing for why inflation will tend to keep on disappointing over the long term, is that food prices still have probably more downside in the multi-year spectrum in terms of just much more efficiencies coming through in the food sector. But that said, short-term, they look like they definitely kind of bottomed out in January, and there's probably a little bit more upside in the rest of 2018.
We talked about China last time. Chinese equities have moved lower, and the momentum is still to the downside. What do you see for both the Chinese currency, Chinese equities, and also the debt overhang that exists in China? A lot of people, of course, have predicted that eventually the unwind of China's credit excess is going to be ugly.
Yeah, look, I'm still constructive in the Chinese yuan. I think that's something I've kind of always been very kind of positive in the Chinese yuan the last year or so, and I still think it's a good story. I think ultimately it's a currency backed by strong growth. It's backed by a decent high yield. It tends to be a very low volatility currency. So overall, I think that the story is still good for the yuan, and I think it will continue to be managed in a way that makes it appealing whenever those high yields are there, in some ways to nearly be a carry currency of one way, and nearly kind of a safe haven as well. So I think the yuan is good. Chinese equities, as you mentioned, the momentum is still very negative. It's looking really, really terrible in the short term. It does worry me about the dynamic that's going on there. Is there something I'm missing? Is this sending a signal on Chinese growth that maybe we were kind of overlooking? Certainly, it worries me as someone who kind of went through the GFC and remembers that in 2007, it was Chinese equities that kind of collapsed much before everything else and kind of sent a signal that there was something going on. I am kind of wary to be of the negative momentum in Chinese equities. That said, valuations just seem like incredibly low. Generally, kind of forward-looking PE metrics across most of the major indices in China, looking below 12, and looking, you know, it's looking really positive. And as I said, growth is very good. I think the government is handling the deleveraging process very smoothly, maybe not as quickly as some people want, but certainly very smoothly. So I think the story is very good there. And finally, you mentioned about the debt problem. And as I said to you in January, this is not something that concerns me in the short term. Yes, there is a very, very large corporate debt bubble. Yes, it is still growing. Yes, it bears a long-term risk. But it's only one part of the equation, and the whole part of the equation is very, very positive in China. China Inc. is very wealthy. China has the ability to deal with this problem. It doesn't mean that if this problem blows up, there won't be financial market disruption. But I think the people who get way too bared up on China are just focused too narrowly on just one facet of the equation, and that's the Chinese corporate debt bubble. But they're ignoring the fact that the Chinese government is wealthy. The Chinese government is enacting some very clever kind of reforms slowly at the margin. And also we have the fact that the private sector is doing very well and has a high savings rate, and the banking sector is doing well, and there's a lot of innovation in the companies there.
Let's move over to Europe. We've had several guests comment that they think Mario Draghi may be about to run out of bullets. What do you see on the horizon for Europe?
It's kind of, as we discussed back in January, Europe's, I think it's a less exciting story. Euro was a great story to play last year, but it's kind of run out. As expected, Italy proved to be a red herring in terms of the politics there has been a mess, but it hasn't really mattered for the currency. And I just don't think that Euro is where there's an exciting story at the moment. The one thing I'll say that, though, it's not all of Europe. Eastern Europe's becoming more interesting again. We're starting to see faster growth in some of the Eastern European countries. They have some kind of problems in the short term, especially with some of the tensions around Russia and how that might spill over. And Turkey, of course, has some real geopolitical issues. But you're seeing countries, including Turkey, but Turkey, Poland, Romania, they're seeing growth over 4%. And I think Eastern Europe is becoming more interesting again because it's been kind of been left over, forgotten. But overall, Europe to me is less interesting plays at the moment than either US or in Asia.
Let's move on to emerging markets. The MSCI Emerging Markets Index is about 4% weaker than last time we spoke. What do you see on the horizon for emerging markets?
So it's very much in line with my broader equity view that kind of mentioned in terms of my broader global outlook, in terms of that, like, I expect some more downside in the months ahead. And EM quite often can be higher beta, and there's probably a lot of reason to think that particularly some countries in EM really need a bit more of a correction. For example, Indian equities are still expensive, but overall, I am really, really super bullish EM still longer term, and I think that's where the real long-term juice is, when we can kind of return to playing the bullish theme for the structural longer-term kind of bull market, which I expect to happen in kind of the second half of this year. And I also still think that Asia is at the center of that. Fundamentally, structurally, it's where the growth is. It's where the demographics are. It's where some of the reform is happening. It's where some of the exciting things are happening on the corporate side. And it's a lot of the times the valuations are very attractive, as we mentioned in China, but Hong Kong, a lot of Asian valuations are still exceptionally attractive. There are some countries that are a little bit overpriced still, and India is probably one of the best examples there, but it's got such a good macro story longer term. So I think there's a lot of event risk about the China-Hong Kong story, which is maybe why valuations are low. The Hong Kong peg is certainly one thing that's causing concern at the moment. And of course, the whole deleveraging reform in China, does make people worry about kind of some financial market disruption. But overall, the EM story is just exceptionally positive longer term. And I think Asia is very much at the forefront of that.
Let's go a little deeper on the Hong Kong peg. That's something that has absolutely fascinated me. As our listeners know, we've seen weakness in the Hong Kong dollar. The Hong Kong Monetary Authority is having difficulty defending their currency. It's at its extreme limit of the band that they've defined for the peg. Why is this happening? And the thing that just baffles me, Mark, is I've wondered, it seems like there's so many good reasons to think that rate differentials ought to be causing flight of capital out of other currencies due to a carry trade into the U.S. dollar. And that seems to explain what's going on here. But why is it happening with the Hong Kong dollar and not with euros, say? I mean, the differential to U.S. treasuries over German bunds, for example, is at least as appealing. Why is it just happening here?
I think there's a few dynamics here. I think one is that because we have this currency peg, it nearly becomes a kind of free trade to kind of collect that carry differential because you're not so worried what's going to happen on the spot side. And so because Hong Kong has left the divergence between US yields and Hong Kong yields widen a bit too much, that is becoming attractive for financial participants to kind of play that and collect that carry there. So there definitely is this pressure on the Hong Kong dollar. And I think it's been greater pressure than people expected in terms of the amount of interventions per day has been quite large. That said, Hong Kong is a massive war chest, and they can certainly rectify this if they want to. I think they're worried about the signaling, but I do think that ultimately they win. I do not fear the peg breaking. And like 1997, I think it was, it provides a great example of this, of when, just do not take the other side of the HKMA, because they will win and they will kind of destroy you on this. And they're also ultimately probably backed by Beijing. And that may be the prompt for when we finally change this. So how does this play out? I must admit, I'm still trying to formulate some of my own views about this. The moment. But I think they don't want to suddenly react too quickly on the rate side, because they fear that might send a message of panic. And obviously, we do have the kind of property bubble in Hong Kong, and they're worried about putting too much pressure on that by kind of jumping up rates too quickly. But I think at some point in the kind of weeks ahead, they're probably going to start leaving local rates rise. They might do that by issuing some front-end bills, but just basically withdrawing some liquidity from the system so the front-end rates come a little bit higher, and that hopefully probably eases some of the pressure on the Hong Kong peg, dollar peg. This might play out over the next kind of couple of weeks, months. It's not probably something that's going to happen in a day. And if that doesn't work, well, then I think we'll see some more drastic measures. But I think they'll be worried about the kind of the panic signal that might set. What is interesting is there's a kind of a theory in the market is, you know, why is there all this excess liquidity in Hong Kong? And one of the arguments is that, you know, there's all this money that's just come out of the Hong Kong stock market, or in the stock markets generally, is just sitting in cash, either coming from the mainland in China or coming from Hong Kong itself and sitting in cash and hasn't got back into the equity market yet. And when you look at equity market valuations, that does make sense. I mean, there's a massive discount for Hong Kong and Chinese equities that just look too cheap relative to forward expected earnings compared to most of the rest of the world. And there's all this money that's just waiting to get in. And I think while you've got this deleveraging drive in China that's sending a signal that maybe equity market there won't be allowed to rise too quickly anytime soon, or it won't, at least won't be able to given the pressure, I think that money is not incentivized to kind of pile back into the market. But ultimately, this Hong Kong dollar peg is definitely a very interesting story, but I don't think it's likely to lead to a break of the peg or any kind of collapse.
Finally, let's come back to the United States. You've already described your views on the equity market, but let's tie it back to the U.S. economic story. What do you see on the horizon for growth and inflation, and how does that relate to markets?
U.S. growth is good. I think we've probably seen the kind of peak in terms of acceleration. I don't think it's going to run away, but I think it's solid. I think we're looking at kind of heading towards about 2.8% growth this year. And I think inflation seems to be, I think consensus forecasts are now kind of verging around 2.5%. I don't see that inflation is going to accelerate to the top side. I'm not someone who's worried about that, which is why I'm not someone who's a long-term bond bear. I do think that we continue to see that for a number of kind of reasons, that wage growth is not feeding through to the CPI basket, and therefore we're not getting that kind of inflation pickup. So I think that inflation probably is, you know, roughly stable around here, just a bit above 2%, which we'll kind of see this year, which I think that the Fed will be very happy with. And I think overall it looks good. It kind of goes with their arbitrary target. And I think growth about 2.8% looks a little bit disappointing, but I'm not sure we're going to have the positive surprises come through. We did get the tax deal come through from Trump last year, and that has provided a boost mainly to corporate earnings, but it will feed through the economy as well. We're seeing a little bit of sign of that, but I'm not sure we're going to get much more. Even if we get this big commodity infrastructure plan, the numbers that have been talked about in the past, you know, $1 trillion over a decade, really isn't that much and is much less than the U.S. needs in terms of overhauling its infrastructure. So I think the U.S. growth story is perfectly solid. I don't think that we're near a recession. I don't think the end of the cycle is near, and that's why I think it's going to be generally supportive for equity markets. I just don't think there's going to be an exciting acceleration, and therefore the juiciest part of the bull market trade of, you know, the last 8 years or so has been kind of done, but there is still some more upside.
Finally, Mark, you are a prolific writer and your blog posts are absolutely outstanding. Unfortunately, your best writing is restricted to Bloomberg Terminal subscribers. So please first tell that part of our audience who's fortunate enough to be on the terminal where they can find your writings. And for our remaining audience who is not so fortunate to be on the Bloomberg Terminal, is there any place to follow you? Are you on Twitter or anything? And where can they find out more about you?
Yeah, thanks. So first of all, for terminal users, MLIVGo brings you to the Markets Live blog, and that's where we have a whole team of kind of ex-traders, strategists, senior editors kind of commenting on markets and kind of giving short analysis, quick analysis of markets. That's the main place. There's the macro view column, NI space macro view, and that kind of gives kind of daily editorials from an individual on a specific facet of the market. They're probably the two main places to get on the terminal. I'm going to be really disappointing and for the retail audience, I'm not even on Twitter. I avoid all social media. And apart from Bloomberg TV, it's probably pretty hard to find my stuff.
Well, they'll have to look for you on Bloomberg TV or your next Macro Voices appearance. Mark, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests
to requests at macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag at macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
No, Eric, that was a great interview with Mark, but we're now joined with Jeffrey Snyder. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
No problem. And so we're going to get to this interview with Jeffrey here in just a second, but I wanted to touch on this with you, Eric. Mark obviously turned bearish on the markets pretty quick along the top. Obviously, he does think that this is a market correction and that eventually we're still going to rally to new highs, but he still thinks that this is not over. I thought that was really interesting because there's more and more people that are in that camp thinking that that was it. But clearly, he's in that camp that there's one more leg in this. What did you take away from the interview?
Yeah, and that still is my view, too. I think there's plenty of room to push to new highs before it's ultimately over, although I do think we're in a topping process. What I found most interesting, though, maybe because it's near and dear to my own heart, was just how confident he was. He seemed to have no concern whatsoever about the Hong Kong Monetary Authority's ability to defend the peg. And I talked to a friend of mine in Hong Kong, ex-Morgan Stanley banker, who had a similar view, just said, hey, look, you know, they got plenty of money, they're going to defend the peg. That's one of the reasons that I've been keen, Jeff, to get you on the program. I want to come back to that subject in just a few minutes. But before we get to the Hong Kong dollar, let's stay on our general theme for the show, which is the stock market. We're at the end from a time perspective. It's about 10, 12 weeks after the first big shock down. If it was a correction and it's going to correct to the upside, it ought to be correcting to the upside pretty soon. Do you think this is a correction that's ending, or do you think that we're at the beginning of something much worse that's got much further to go to the downside, or where do you see things headed in the stock market from here?
Well, Eric, I think it's a little too soon to tell which way it goes from here. I think what we do notice is that the stock markets have been drawn into what was a liquidation or an air pocket of sorts. And I think that explains a good deal of why it's been in this downward sideways range for now. As you pointed out, Eric, I think the market's been moving sideways or slightly lower for the last 12 weeks or so, which is kind of an unusual move and in a correction toward the normal V-shape that you normally see. So I think it's an important distinction in that it suggests that the stock market, which had been pretty much invulnerable over the last couple of years, has been drawn into what I think is a wider monetary issue of global dollar liquidity.
All right, Jeff. Now, what are the reasons that we brought you back on the show is because right now everyone's buzzing about this Hong Kong dollar. But I mean, you've been writing about the Hong Kong dollar for over a year, and you're the one that put it on my radar about a month ago before anyone was really even talking about it. And a month ago, you wrote a piece that you were saying, you know, you didn't need the LIBOR OIS spreads or the what was going on in the repo and collateral markets or the cross-currency basis issues. All of this, you just really didn't need to understand what was going on in the Hong Kong dollar. And I didn't fully even understand what you meant by that. And I'd love to understand, why is it that the Hong Kong dollar, in your mind, was such an important thing to watch?
First of all, it's not supposed to happen in Hong Kong. I mean, Hong Kong is quite rightly viewed as an ocean of stability. In any kind of monetary or global crisis, that's the place you put your money, because Hong Kong has been for a very long time the place that you can depend upon. It's the utmost in terms of safety, stability, and predictability. And so the very fact that the Hong Kong dollar had begun to fall was immediately raised a bunch of warning flags. And then when you start to think about why that might be, it ties into everything else we've been talking about, which is this dollar issue. But what I think has happened is that what we can tell by the Hong Kong dollar's movements that almost exactly and perfectly mirror the movements in the Chinese currency is that the Hong Kong banks or financial system or whoever in the city have been borrowing in dollar markets on behalf of their Chinese counterparts. Now, how those dollars go from Hong Kong into China isn't known, and I don't think we'll ever probably know, but we can reasonably assume that the Hong Kong firms have been more active in dollars for that purpose. And because they're more active in dollars, Hong Kong has become almost as a proxy for China far riskier than maybe it should be, or maybe it should be perceived as. And so the fall in the Hong Kong dollar starts to get our attention in terms of liquidity risk, as well as an erosion, perhaps, of its perception of safety.
Jeff, I'm particularly curious to get your reactions. Mark Cudmore in this last interview told us he wasn't concerned at all about the Hong Kong Monetary Authority's ability to defend the currency. He says they've got plenty of money. I talked to another friend of mine who's an ex-Morgan Stanley banker, said basically the same thing, which is, just as you said a few minutes ago, Hong Kong has a famous reputation for being the center of stability. So it seems like they've got plenty of Hong Kong dollars to defend the currency with. I know from talking to you off the air, you are not necessarily convinced that that's something that's safe to bet on. You think that people with exposure there should be concerned about the possibility of the peg actually failing and the Hong Kong Monetary Authority being unable to defend that peg. First of all, do I understand that view correctly? And if so, why do you think that when so many other people are saying, hey, there's nothing to worry about here?
Well, it's the same story we've heard for the last 10 years, right? I mean, essentially what you're saying is we don't have to worry about it because the Monetary Authority has it all under control. They've got plenty of ammunition. And I say, well, where have we heard that before? I mean, when haven't we heard that? And it never seems to turn out that way. And I think that view is derived from a mistaken impression of what central banks, or in this case, a monetary authority, can actually accomplish. And it doesn't ever appear to be what everybody thinks. I mean, start with the panic in 2008. That wasn't supposed to be possible, yet it happened. Chinese currency wasn't supposed to devalue. I mean, you go back 3 years ago, before all that happened, we heard the same exact thing. The Chinese have the largest stockpile of reserves on the planet. There's no possible way that the CNY could ever fall into a currency crisis, yet it happened. I don't want to call it laziness. I don't think it's derived from that. I think it's probably too strong a word, but people are just not curious enough about how the system actually works. And there's this tendency to defer to, especially to monetary authorities, whenever we get into these situations without appreciating the fact that we are in this situation. I mean, why is the Hong Kong dollar falling at all? Their answers to me ring very hollow. And the fact that they're already being obliged to defend the peg and doing so pretty heavily over the last week already suggests that, you know, there's more to the story than just they have a bunch of reserves and can easily handle what's going on.
Now, Jeff, I have to ask, what we've heard over and over again is that this is about traders with the carry trade and the differences between the HIBOR and LIBOR rates, and traders are piling on this, and this is what's creating that imbalance and the pressure. Do you see it that way? Is that where the pressure on the Hong Kong dollar is coming from?
Actually, the HKMA has given us that explanation as well as another one, and both of which, to me, again, as I said before, don't seem to make a whole lot of sense. The other explanation, I'll just take that first, is that they say that because Hong Kong is a place for stability and low risk, starting in 2008 and 2009, they experienced a tremendous amount of safety inflows. And so quite naturally, they would expect as the global economy recovers and we go back to normal, that those inflows would turn into outflows. And according to the HKMA, under this theory, they put out a press release to this effect last month. Part of what's going on in the Hong Kong dollar, according to them, is the reverse of safety flows. I find that hard to believe to begin with, but that's what they say. The other part of it is, as you guys point out, is this interest rate differential theory or a carry trade. And again, I don't think that's what's going on either. This seems to be an issue of more than just Hong Kong, and we can bring in Japan as well. But what we're talking about here in terms of interest rate differential is, why isn't it having an effect in other places in the same exact way? It seems to be an issue for Hong Kong, which used to be the place where everybody believed was stable and predictable. And the fact that the Hong Kong dollar has fallen as far as it has suggests that that's no longer the case, or no longer perceived to be the case. So that would be an issue, especially in terms of the carry trade.
So if you don't think that's what it is, Jeff, what is it then? Clearly, we're seeing something with the Hong Kong dollar that's not happening elsewhere. We certainly don't see a massive flow of euros, you know, buying U.S. dollars because they are desperate to take advantage of the better yields on U.S. treasuries. It's Hong Kong specific. So if it's not a carry trade, what is it?
Again, it's Hong Kong's unique situation in relationship to China. Because it's a separate system, but it's still a Chinese city. I mean, the Chinese government took over in the late 90s. It operates as almost an adjunct but separate arm of what the Chinese are doing, or what the Chinese monetary authorities have done in the past. And in that way, it allows almost a separate window into China in a way that doesn't seem as risky as it might be doing business directly with Chinese banks, for example, in terms of dollar markets. So what I think is going on isn't necessarily safety flows, especially with regard to China, because If anything, the Chinese economy seems to be slowing, not picking up, and there's more financial risk in China, not less. And so to me, it's a funding issue, a global funding issue, whereby Hong Kong is being used as a monetary or dollar bypass for the Chinese system, which would put the spotlight on Hong Kong and Hong Kong alone. And I think that's why we're seeing such a severe reaction with the Hong Kong dollar as opposed to anywhere else.
Well, Jeff, you've been writing about the Hong Kong dollar, as we said earlier, for more than a year now. We've provided links in the Research Roundup email for our listeners to a couple of the most interesting recent ones, one from about a month ago titled A Few More Pips. There's another one titled Can We Blame Japan for the Liquidations and the Hong Kong Dollar? But Jeff, the third article, which is titled Some First Principles of a Dollar Short, I'd like to talk a little bit more about, because you've talked to us about this subject in Eurodollar University and then again in our year-end show. I think what has a lot of people confused is when they hear about the dollar short, immediately what comes to mind is short sellers, people who are making a speculative bet on the dollar going down. In order to implement that bet, they're selling dollars or dollar index futures short. You're not talking about that kind of speculative short selling. You mean something else by the dollar short. Please elaborate.
Yeah, and it's one of the problems that we get into with this idea of Eurodollar system is that the language involved with it and some of the technical terms involved with it are confusing, often ambiguous, often we use the terms in ways that they're not previously used. And so it does become very confusing. And if you're running across it for the first time, I can completely sympathize and understand why you would have so much trouble because, you know, when we're talking about a dollar short, we are not in any way talking about a bet on the direction of the dollar. That's not what we're talking about at all. What we're really talking about, what we're really dealing with is the way the system actually works. And in many ways, it is understandable in the traditional format. It's the difference between constantly rolling over short-term funding but holding long-term positions. In other words, your asset base is all longer maturity stuff, but you have to fund that stuff on a daily basis. And so there's a mismatch between funding and holding of assets. And into that mismatch, because we're talking about across geographical boundaries and in terms of different currencies often, you know, when we talk about Chinese being dollar short, we're talking about a Chinese banking system that requires dollar funding on a daily basis or a short-term basis for its dollar holdings that are longer term in nature. And that's the short we're talking about, the potential mismatch between short-term liabilities and longer-term assets.
Well, Jeff, this is a fantastic article with excellent graphics that make it very clear with pictures what we're really talking about. I want to encourage our listeners to read it. Again, it's linked in your Research Roundup email. Give us a quick summary of what the conclusions are for anyone who might not have a chance to read the full article.
Well, the conclusions are that the situation where the dollar system itself is under immense chronic strain because essentially euro dollars or the various formats of euro dollars, whether it be derivative FX or anything else, from the global banking system that provides the capacity for those dollars to be created and redistributed throughout the global banking system doesn't want to do this business anymore because of its perceived riskiness. And that's what brings us into focus upon China and Hong Kong. Going back to 2013, especially the perception of risk from Japanese banks, who were the main point of redistribution of dollars into China, was that the Chinese were no longer I don't want to say riskless situation, but it was believed after the crisis that emerging markets in China especially were the place to put money because the Chinese economy would always grow at pre-crisis rates, that there was no problem in the Chinese economy that couldn't be fixed by growth. After and around 2013, however, we started to realize that China's economy was experiencing the same problems as everyone else's, and therefore it was just as risky, or maybe not just as risky, but the risk perceptions were changing with regard to dollar funding of Chinese banks. And so over the last several years, Japanese banks have started to withdraw from the dollar business, which has exposed China increasingly to these chronic and often acute shortages, which is essentially what happened in 2015 and 2016. And the way in which the Chinese have tried to deal with their dollar problem, which has not gone away, is through different and various means of experimentation. They've tried several internal measures, and I think that the last one that they reached for early last year was to use this Hong Kong bypass. In other words, to stand Hong Kong banks out to the Eurodollar markets in front of Chinese banks because of their reputation for stability, creditworthiness, and lack of liquidity risk. And so the prognosis is, of course, unless the dollar system ever gets itself together, we're going to keep having these kinds of liquidity issues, liquidations, and all sorts of other risks, including economic risks, until it's resolved one way or the other, which is what we talked about at the year-end show about the dollar system, the dollar squeeze, the dollar bear, or the dollar bull.
And of course, Jeff, you have written extensively on this subject and many others in your blog at alhambrapartners.com. We discussed it, as you just mentioned, in the year-end show, which we did with Luke Groman and Mark Yusko. Listeners can find that by going to macrovoices.com and clicking on the Timeless Series button on the black menu bar at the top of our homepage at macrovoices.com. And likewise, you'll also find Euro Dollar University there, which is a series of programs we did with Jeff last year, really going through the history of the Eurodollar system. We are working, incidentally, with Jeff on Season 2 of Eurodollar University, which will be coming to you later this year. Jeff, I cannot thank you enough for another fantastic interview. Listeners, we need your help promoting the program, so please tell your friends and colleagues, forward your research roundup emails, and most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com, because the more registered users we have, the more able Patrick is to negotiate to get the very best feature interview guests. The benefit to you is that you'll receive our free research roundup email each week, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just a compilation of links to all the best content that we could find on the internet each week. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
So this week, you're going to find the transcript for all three interviews that we've had. You'll also find the link to the chart book prepared by Harley Bassman. There's also the links to the Jeffrey Snyder articles we referenced in the interview. There's also an interesting article from Kevin Muir titled No Better Signal Than the Yield Curve. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.
Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.